Morning, Council. Ready to proceed?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, I would like to present oral argument this morning on behalf of my client, Michael Jones. Although our brief contains several issues, today our plan is to present argument on three issues. I will present an argument on the Confrontation Clause issue, then I will address the judicial bias issue, and I'm going to reserve 5 minutes for Mr. O'Connell to discuss the Batson issue. The first argument concerns certain hearsay statements of co-defendant Darrell Page, which were introduced at trial through a 3507 statement and through the direct testimony of his girlfriend, Kim Still. Kim Still was clearly one of the state's two most important witnesses in the case. Darrell Page, the co-defendant, was her boyfriend. She made a 5-hour videotaped statement to the police the morning after the murders, and towards the end of those 5 hours, after she changed her story several times, at the climax of her story, she spent about 2 minutes telling the police that her boyfriend, Darrell Page, had confessed to her that he was planning to kill Cedric Reinford by having my client, Michael Jones, shoot Reinford to make it look like a drug deal gone bad. And later, during the testimony, she repeated those same things she told the police in front of the jury. Today, we're here to discuss what was said during those 2 minutes and why those hearsay statements should not have been admitted in her direct testimony or through the 3507 statement. We submit that the introduction of Page's hearsay statements were an obvious and direct violation of Jones' Confrontation Clause rights. In Barra v. State, this court held that blame-shifting hearsay statements of accomplices are inadmissible, and this court relied on a long line of United States Supreme Court cases which have consistently held accomplice confessions that inculpate a criminal defendant are not within a firmly rooted exception to the hearsay rule. Lilly v. Virginia, Lee v. Illinois, White v. Illinois. In addressing this issue, the state has taken the position that since Page's statements about Jones made up such a small part of Still's 5-hour statement, there should be no Confrontation Clause issue. I guess they're saying it's minimized because it's just a small part of what she had to say. Well, I'm not aware of any authority from this court or from the U.S. Supreme Court that substituted a quantity scale in place of substance in determining Confrontation Clause issues. What is important here is
there can be harmless error, can't there, or not?
Harmless error is implicated in this case. I would submit that the state did not raise harmless error in its brief. They did not make that as a defense to my claim, but I would agree with the court that these claims can be reviewed by harmless error, although that was not briefed by the state. I believe I did address harmless error in my reply brief. What is important here is that the co-defendant indicated that it was going to be Michael Jones as the shooter. The cases by the state do nothing but point out how easy it would have been to redact these two statements to make them admissible. The point of both Richardson versus Marsh and Smith versus State was that confrontation caused problems can often be avoided by simply redacting the statement to omit any mention of the defendant. Instead of, quote, I'm going to get Michael Jones to shoot Reinford while I rob him to make it look like a drug deal gone bad, Page's statement could have been redacted to say, I'm going to rob Reinford and make it look like a drug deal gone bad. There's another way to reveal the fallacy in the state's argument, and that is by taking the state's argument to its logical extension. In other words, if the state really thought that Page's statement implicating Jones was admissible in its original form, if they really thought that the statement did not present a Confrontation Clause issue, then why didn't they try these two defendants together? In other words, what sense did it make to sever their cases if the state truly felt that there was no Confrontation Clause issue which required severance? And the way I see it, there can only be two reasons for that. One, they asked for everything, never expecting to get everything, but hoping to get maybe more than they might normally be entitled to. Or, to address Justice Ridgely's question about harmless error, they recognized that their key witnesses had such serious credibility problems that they were willing to risk this appeal if it would help strengthen a weak case. There was no physical evidence in this case. There was no DNA. There was no confession on the part of Michael Jones. The only evidence that the state had against Michael Jones was the testimony of two witnesses who had serious credibility problems and Page's hearsay statement. So we submit that if you're going to take the harmless error analysis, which the state did not take, that we submit that this was a close case, that their witnesses had great credibility. And the reason why the state gambled on this was because they realized it was a close case and were willing to take the risk. But the risk violated my client's Confrontation Clause rights. There are no further questions on that issue, then I am prepared to move into the judicial bias argument. Two of the most important fundamental rights that every defendant has in a criminal case are these: the right to an unbiased tribunal and the right to counsel. And unbelievably, both of these rights were implicated in this case in stunning, bizarre, and extraordinary circumstances. The right to counsel issue came first. In this case, the defendant overheard an attorney in the office of his attorneys say, "That guy looks like a typical murderer to me," not once, but twice. He asked the court to appoint new, unbiased attorneys to represent him in this case. He exercised his Sixth Amendment right, and he was successful. He was appointed two new attorneys, Mr. O'Connell and myself. 14 months later, during trial, Mr. O'Connell and I go down to Sublock one morning before trial and have to tell our client, "Michael, we have something we have to tell you. Witnesses have come forward who've said they overheard the trial judge sitting at a bar telling another person that she plans to give you the death penalty." A credible witness had indeed come forward and executed an affidavit stating that she overheard the judge say that she was going to give my client the death penalty. The defense submits that that affidavit is evidence of judicial bias. And the defendant further asserts that as a result of judicial bias, my client's due process right to a trial before an impartial judge was violated in this case. The United States Supreme Court has said that a defendant's right to a trial before an impartial judge is the most basic fair trial right that can never be treated as harmless, because a trial before a biased judge is fundamentally unfair.
The timing of that, just so that I'm clear on that, the statement by the trial judge was after the guilt phase?
After the guilt phase, before the penalty. Before the penalty was imposed, while the penalty phase was in process.
Whose case was being presented at that time? Was it?
On the night of the 14th, the state's case had, I believe that we presented three witnesses at that point.
So it was during the defense case?
It was during the defense case. The existence of bias would render a trial fundamentally flawed and require a new trial. In responding to allegations of actual bias, the judge in question is supposed to engage in a subjective analysis. To conduct a subjective analysis on a claim of actual bias, the judge must examine his or her own conscience or mental state. On appeal, this court must then review that subjective analysis for abuse of discretion.
Well, in your argument, are you making a distinction between having a fair trial and having a sentence considered fairly? And first, if the statements you attribute to the judge, the affidavit attributes to the judge, seem to relate to a sentence, that became an impossibility, so the client got life, how did the bias affect anything other than the possible sentence?
I have a number of responses to that. I would say that the closest case on point is the Antar case, which was cited in the brief, and which, in fact, this court cited in the Stevenson case. In Antar, the judge made a statement at sentencing, I'm going to do what it was my plan to do from day one, which was to get the money back for the victims in this case. And the reviewing court looked at that and said, that's an expression of bias, and bias can affect the whole trial. Bias is a subtle poison. You can't always see it. And in Antar, he didn't just get a new sentencing, he got a new trial. Now, Your Honor, I would also ask the court to review the Gomez case, U.S. versus Gomez, which I cited in the brief. And that case discussed, how can you tell bias from a record? And that case was basically discussing the selection of jurors in a trial. In that case, it was handled by a magistrate. The question was, should the magistrate have handled it or not? But the question became, is a magistrate capable of looking for bias? And would a trial judge reviewing the record be able to see bias? And the Supreme Court said this: the court must not only scrutinize spoken words, but also gestures and attitudes of all participants to ensure the jury's impartiality. But only words can be preserved for review. No transcript can recapture the atmosphere which may persist throughout trial. So, if we have an expression of bias, and it's a clear expression of bias, and it's an actual expression of bias, we submit that it's a fundamental constitutional flaw. The client deserves a new trial. In this case, in the March 24th decision, the judge said, and I'll speak more about this later, Mr. Capone behaved contemptuously by body language. But if you were to look at that record, and I deny that, but if you were to look at that record, you'd say, where does Mr. Capone behave contemptuously? It's not reflected in the record. And that goes back to my original statement that bias is a subtle poison. You can't, doesn't always show up in the record. And if it's expressed, it affects the whole trial. Our fundamental right to an unbiased judge, and therefore my client should get a new trial. This court has told us in Stevenson that any inquiry into a judge's impartiality is case-specific. In this case, at this point in time, we have three specific sources of information on the issue of actual bias to help measure the judge's subjective bias analysis for abuse of discretion. And those three things are these. We have the affidavit of the witness. We have the trial judge's March 24th opinion. And we have the trial record.
Well, isn't what the trial judge said, that she basically said, I didn't make that comment. It's false. Isn't that what she ultimately said? And if that's accurate, if I'm reciting it accurately, I mean, where do we go from there?
Okay. Well, you have to review, I guess this is a credibility question, and this is where I'm heading now, the next part of my argument now. She is entitled to make a subjective analysis, and you are obligated to review that under the abuse of discretion standards. And now I would like to explain to you why I believe there was an abuse of discretion.
Well, did she say it was false? Basically, the affidavits were false to the extent that she had announced that she was going to impose the death penalty.
She said, I agree with almost 98% of what the witness said, but on the question of whether I said I was going to give the client the death penalty, this is what I said instead, and this is how I am going to prove it to you, the court and the attorneys, that this is what I really said. And therefore, I suggest that we should examine the affidavit, the judge's opinion, and compare it to the record. The judge does admit discussing the case. She does admit discussing Mr. O'Connell in pejorative terms. And what she says was, what I was really saying, instead of I'm going to give this guy the death penalty, what I was really saying was this, quote, she said that Mr. O'Connell botched the case so bad that it made it practically inevitable that the jury would strongly vote death, a recommendation I would probably have to follow regardless of my personal convictions. I was going to be stuck with a 10-2 vote to execute a juvenile. To support that statement, her version of the events, she points to several incidents in her March 24th opinion, which led her to the point where she says, I was at Phoebe recounting what a terrible trial I was going through and what a terrible job defense counsel was doing. Now, the state has read that opinion, but presumably they've read the record in this case. The state has taken the position that the trial judge's opinion was blunt, honest, and forthright, and that there's no reason to doubt Judge Abelman's denial that she bore any bias or prejudice to the defendant. So one of the things I need to discuss today is this. Does the record support her version of the events? I'd like to read you something from the record, something the judge said to counsel at the conclusion of the penalty phase on February 17th, 2005, just 3 days after the conversation at Phoebe's. And this is what she said to counsel. I think you all did an absolutely excellent job in trying this case. I'm extremely impressed with the manner in which this case has been tried, and I want to thank you for that. May I also say one thing? I thought the closing arguments in this phase of the case were superior. They were probably some of the finest closing arguments I've ever heard. What the trial judge said on February 17th, 3 days after the Phoebe's dinner, and what she said on March 24th in the opinion, are diametrically opposed. They were 180 degrees different. And if her subjective analysis was meant to convince you that the penalty phase was not handled in an absolutely excellent manner, but in a totally botched manner, then what was the point of including in the opinion the section about me, titled, Mr. Capone Behaves Disrespectfully, for an incident which she says occurred 2 weeks before the penalty phase began? And there's something else you should be aware of. When the judge's opinion was first issued on March 22nd, the section was titled, Mr. Capone Behaves Unethically. And it asserted that I unethically approached the prosecutor and asked him to contact the judge at home to ask on my behalf for a scheduling accommodation. It just never happened. But there was, in print, out of a judge's office, saying that I had behaved unethically and had nothing to do with the penalty phase, had nothing to do with what I submit should have been a subjective analysis. These inconsistencies between the March 24th opinion and the record, as well as the internal inconsistencies in the opinion itself, raise the question of whether the judge's opinion reflects a rational, subjective consideration of the bias question. Because if it doesn't, it's an abuse of discretion.
Did you want to save any time for rebuttal?
I did, but I'm...
It's your option.
Let me keep going then. I would also submit that one of the key factual discrepancies in that opinion is she uses an incident where Mr. O'Connell supposedly completely botched the testimony of a defense expert, Dr. Ragland, as accounting for her feelings at Phoebe's restaurant that night. I hope the court realizes that that did not occur until the day after the dinner at Phoebe's. At the point of the dinner at Phoebe's, we presented only three witnesses, the mother, the sister, and the correction officer. They went without a hitch. There was no problem. There's one other thing I would like to say. At this point, I've spoken on behalf of my client. Judge Abelman has had her statement. She said that Mr. O'Connell and I were unethical. She insinuated that he suborned perjury. And she took a strong stand against attorneys, unethical attorneys, doing this now or in the future. But there's one other person who has some claim, I think, that needs to be brought forward today. And that's the witness who, by fate or by chance or by coincidence, was sitting on a bar stool at Phoebe's and overheard this, and had the courage to come forward and submit an affidavit to the court, in public, saying, this is what I heard. It doesn't sound right. And I think she brought that affidavit before a judicial system because she believes, as the rest of us do, that it's the best judiciary in the country, and that when people come to this court in good faith, they expect that our judiciary will treat them with respect and in good faith. Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Kevin O'Connell, and thank you for this opportunity to argue the Batson issue on behalf of my client, Michael Jones. Because of the shortness of the time, I won't recount the law that you're all very familiar with respect to Batson. In this case, we had the state essentially striking six out of its eight peremptory challenges were against minorities, five African Americans and a Hispanic woman, Maria Alonzo. The state has argued that, well, by virtue of the fact that 25% of this jury, including the alternate, was of minority status, that you should not see any Batson claim here. The important statistic for the court to look at, though, and I think that the case law points this out, Batson and Jones versus Ryan, a Third Circuit case, isn't the percentage of minorities on the actual jury. It's the percentage of minorities in the veneer, in this case just over 18%, as compared to, pardon me, as compared to the number of strikes exercised by the state against minorities, in this case 75%. In other words, if there is no racial animus in their jury selection process, those percentages should be the same. In other words, their strikes of minority should be about 18%. When it's as much as four times...
Is it strictly an issue of numbers and percentage, or isn't the focus supposed to be on was there some rational basis for the exercise of the peremptory challenge by the state other than race?
Absolutely. I agree with that observation completely.
And what does the record show here about that?
What the record shows here is that the three reasons given for striking African-Americans and Maria Alonzo, the Hispanic woman, were, one, that Mr. Copes was a teacher, two, that Maria Alonzo was a psychologist, and three, that the rest of the people had criminal records. Now, we've seen that the state accepted two white women who were teachers while saying the primary reason for striking Mr. Copes was the fact that he was a teacher, and they otherwise are going to give people the benefit of the doubt because I was a teacher one time, Mr. Walter said, and my daughter's a teacher, my son-in-law's a teacher, and I know how those people are. But he tolerated that with respect to the two white women, juror number two and juror number four, that he accepted. The other person, Mr. Brill, who was an alternate, was an older white man. He was a psychologist, albeit a psychologist who worked in schools looking at testing and abnormal test results. Maria Alonzo was a psychologist, and they struck her, essentially saying, A, she was overeducated, and then when asked to bring, what does that mean, the state said, well, it's because she's a psychologist, and the court agreed. You're probably going to be presenting psychologist testimony. Maybe that's a good reason. Well, when you line two people up against one another, one's white and one's a minority, and they have the same objectionable reason, that's evidence that there's actual pretext going on here.
Was the work that they did in psychology the same or not?
The record really doesn't speak to that, Your Honor. I think that what you see in this case is the state suggesting that Maria Alonzo was a forensic or a clinical psychologist, but it's not apparent in the record from that, either in the pedigree information that we put in our appendix or in her actual testimony that she was a clinical psychologist.
Where did she work?
I think she was in private practice, I think, is all we know, is that she had some sort of private practice. I'm not sure what that was.
Would there be any analogy between, let's say, allowing a tax lawyer to serve but striking a trial lawyer on the theory that their representative background might have undue influence on the other 11 members of the jury?
Perhaps there would be if you had that kind of a record in this case. In this case, we don't. The state has suggested that she was a clinical psychologist. That's not supported by the record. And I believe that it's not in the testimony of Maria Alonzo, and I don't believe it's in the pedigree information that's in our appendix that we've submitted.
But you agree she was in private practice, whatever
I think,
that means.
Quite honestly, I believe that she said that she has a private practice, and I don't know what that means. And I know, for instance, I have a friend, Patricia McGraw, who is in private practice, but it's strictly forensic work that she does. I know lots of people who have private practices that do other things. So it's not really suggested that she's clinical versus, and I don't think that distinction was made by the state in this case. They simply said she was a psychologist, whereas they accepted Mr. Brill, who arguably was more objectionable under their analysis. We were going to have evidence presented through our psychologist that this person had a learning disability, that he had all sorts of types of problems that a school psychologist or person who's going to look at abnormal testing is going to be actually more familiar with. So I think there was actually even more reason to strike Mr. Brill. But I think the most glaring evidence of pretext in this case is the fact that the state continually hid behind the notion that people had criminal records. And we've looked at this issue before in other cases, the Fletcher case, the Garden case, whether or not the defense should have access to the Delgis records. And the law says that we shouldn't have them. But the law has to cut both ways because Michael Jones' equal protection rights trump that statute. The state can't say criminal record, and then not reveal the criminal records or lack of criminal records of white people that they've otherwise ceded.
We'll have to ask you to stop at this point, Mr. Anello.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity.
Good morning. Please, the court. A few comments regarding the Batson issue. First of all, Maria Alonzo did say that she was in private practice. That's on appendix page 897, page 199. The term clinical psychologist is Mr. Brill's, page A104C. Mr. Brill said he was not a clinical psychologist. He had never practiced as a clinical psychologist. His involvement was interpreting test results for learning disabilities and worked for the state and also for, I assume, the state school system. As far as the teachers go, now, the issue of the two psychologists was raised. The issue of the teachers was not. So there is no record here of why Betty Jane Anderson, who was retired as an instructor at Delaware Technical Community College, and Jennifer Towers, who was at that time a teacher at charter school, were seated. We don't know. Simply, the issue wasn't raised. We did know that we do know from the striking of Mr. Copes. Mr. Copes was the first black juror struck, and there was no Batson claim raised at that time. But when the second African-American juror was struck, Mr. Walther, who was doing the jury selection, or at least was at the podium, said, well, as long as we're on the issue, I'll go back and say why I struck Mr. Copes. And that was, first of all, he had a very old criminal record, and dating from, well, he said he was 30 years old, so that would be from the early 80s. And if the court is familiar with criminal records from that time, they're a little bit on the vague side, and very often, as a matter of fact, probably more often than not, don't contain dispositions. But his primary reason then was because he was a retired teacher, and then he went on about Mr. Walther's own personal opinion of teachers. It's an opinion I don't share, but and I would never have made the challenge based on that, but it's simply a race-neutral reason, and again, that's the issue. Did the prosecutor tender a race-neutral reason for the strike? Again, for as far as Mr. Copes goes, the prosecutor didn't have to tender any reason, but he went ahead and did that. Now, as far as the criminal records go, there is no indication on this record that the state would not, in face of a Batson challenge, share with the defense. As a matter of fact, the state noted that Mr. Cope's criminal record was 30 years old. They didn't have Mr. Walther didn't have to say that. And every other challenge, I mean, Mr. Walther said, he has, you know, so many motor vehicle violations, but there was no secret here. And if the defense wanted to challenge a criminal record, the defense, consistent with the statute, certainly, that limits who could see these records, could have asked the trial judge to sit as an arbiter and take a look at the criminal records and confirm them, and that was not done. So there was no unfairness here in the state's use of criminal records. And one final brief point. The state is not arguing percentages. The reason the state put in that rather lengthy footnote with all the names of the strikes, peremptory challenges, I think there were 18 that the defense exercised, was to show that at least 17 of the 18 were white jurors, and the 18th had put down her ethnicity as other, so who knows, I'm probably another white juror, just didn't like the question. But percentages mean nothing. Percentages simply mean nothing. No, the state is focusing on the reasons that were proffered.
When you say percentages mean nothing, do you mean there are no Third Circuit cases or any other cases that talk in terms of percentage of peremptory challenge exercise as opposed to percentages of minorities in the veneer?
Specifically that. I'm not saying there is none. I'm simply saying I'm not aware of that particular percentage. Percentages, I would say, are...
Well, I thought you said percentages mean nothing.
Well, they mean nothing standing alone. Let me say that. As a matter of fact, I mean, the Batson case, the original Batson case, handed down in part to clear that up, that we really just can't look at percentages. We have to go beyond that. We can't just look at statistics going back over the course. Now, there was, yes, certainly a, now that you mention it, a Third Circuit case out of Delaware dealing with, history, if one will, of a former prosecutor's exercise of peremptory challenges to strike black jurors in, I believe it was, Kent County. And there was mention of that, but and we did not appeal that Third Circuit decision, so that stands. I'm not saying that I agree with it. I'm just saying, yes, it is there. Briefly, if I may, just a few comments on the hearsay. The statements to which the defendant now objects. Now, below, he objected to the post-crime statements also, but these were obviously, as the trial judge ruled, these were in the conspiracy was still active at that point. The money had not been divvied up, and they were still looking for a change of clothes. And they were still together. But the pre-crime, at this point, there can be no blame shifting. For the obvious reason that there's been no crime. The only mention that Ms. Still made of the Page's mention of Jones was that he was planning on robbing, not killing necessarily. He said he would kill if he had to. Cedric Reinford would die if that became necessary. There was never any statement that he was definitely, or Jones was definitely going to kill Reinford. But that he, in the future, was going to ask Jones to help him out in this plan. Now, at this point, no crime has been committed. There's no conspiracy because Mr. Jones hasn't been asked. Mr. Page did not tell Kim Still that Jones and I have agreed together to do this, so there's not a conspiracy, there's no substantial step, there's no crime. This is simply words on the part of Mr. Page.
What's the state's theory of admissibility?
It's under 8033, state of mind, which specifically says, talking about plan and intent. And that's what was.
They were planning and intending to do things, but the conspiracy had not started.
No, well, Page was planning at this point. Jones knew nothing about it at this point. Page say, in the future, I am going to ask Jones if he can help me in my conspiracy, in what I'm planning on doing. And apparently he did, because we know that from the later facts of the case, the testimony both of Muhammad Reinford, who for some strange reason survived being shot in the head, and the testimony of Kim Still, who met Page and Jones shortly after the crime in Philadelphia and drove them around, and, of course, from her statements before. So under 8033, it comes in as an exception to the rule against hearsay. Now, as far as why the, if I may briefly again, why the cases were not tried together, my understanding, talking to Mr. Walter about this, is that he was pretty sure there was going to be antagonistic defenses. Apparently, upon his arrest, Mr. Page made a statement, and Mr. Walter couldn't remember if the statement directly implicated Jones or not.
Well, in terms of what the record is, there was a stipulation to separate trials as opposed to a motion to sever? And
I couldn't find a motion to sever. Mr. Wolford told me that they wanted separate trials because he anticipated.
But is that in the record, what you're about to tell us?
No, this is just what Mr. Wolford told me. I mean, it's not on the record either.
So that can't be a basis for our decision in this appeal, can it?
Well, no, neither. No, no. And I thought the court might be interested. But neither can, well, the Mr. My friend Mr. Capone said that there was obvious burden problem. Well, if there was a burden problem, it was going to be against Page. It's not going to be about Jones. Jones made no statement. So there was no burden problem with regard to Jones. So there's no reason to sever the case for that reason. I mean, there's no reason. I meant just the opposite, but there's a burden problem. There's going to be a problem not involving Jones, but involving Page. As to the other issue, the recusal. First of all, the state's primary position, of course, is that at the time the motion was filed, the motion was moot. Simmons v. Roper, the penalty hearing was over. Simmons versus Roper had been decided, and the judge had no discretion in the matter. The defendant was 17 years and 10 months at the time of the crime, and the judge, in light of Simmons v. Roper, had no discretion in the sentencing. Even though the jury may have come back 10-2 in favor of death, the judge was, by constitutional law, required to sentence the defendant to life and not capital punishment.
But if I understand correctly, opposing counsel is taking the position that even though the events took place at a point in time when nothing was left to be done because of the nature of the law and so forth, that it presented clear evidence of the judge's inappropriate views, inappropriate in the sense of being biased, and that presumably infected the case from the very beginning.
Well, as far as the guilt phase, the trial goes, allow me to make 2 points. First of all, the cases such as Lost Be Lost, the main case of this court, always talks about expressions of bias toward a party. In this case, and now here we come to the credibility issue. Now, the defendant paints the witness who did file the affidavit. There were two. One said that he was a career criminal, and so only his girlfriend filed the affidavit. But anyway, the girlfriend affidavit said that the judge, sitting at the restaurant bar waiting for a table, it was not a bar, it's Phoebe's Fishery, it's a restaurant, they have a bar in the waiting room. Again, that's not on the record either, but I happen to be familiar with Phoebe's Fishery. The judge was, according to the affidavit, the judge said that she was going to sentence the defendant to death to have the last word, get even with Kevin O'Connell. Well, I mean, first of all, that didn't happen. But then the judge, in her order, says, no, it didn't happen. Yes, and again, this is where the candor comes. The judge said, yes, I was at Phoebe's Fishery. Yes, I was seated at the bar. Yes, I was talking about the case. And yes, I was dumping all over Mr. O'Connell. I mean, everything that happened, which is why I said it there, like, I'm not going to sugarcoat the facts here. I can't. The judge said everything that happened is as the affidavit said, except I never said once that I was going to impose the death penalty.
Well, help us with a part of the record. The March opinion refers to this cross-examination of the doctor that the judge attributes to Mr. O'Connell as ineffective. And what's your understanding of the record? Mr. Capone tells us that the doctor wasn't cross-examined at the penalty phase until after the incident at the restaurant, and yet the judge's opinion seems to suggest that was Exhibit A in one of her concerns about his ineffectiveness.
Well, the state's position in a nutshell about the record is that after the jury came back guilty, nothing else matters.
Right, my question is, did the doctor testify before or after the restaurant episode?
I'm not sure when he testified. The restaurant episode happened the evening of the first day of the penalty hearing. Now, whoever testified on that first day had testified ahead of time.
If the doctor hadn't testified, there's no way the judge could have been concerned about the cross-examination or the examination of the doctor.
No, if he hadn't testified, no, at that point. No, and, quite frankly, whether the judge was... that his perceptions of my friend, Mr. O'Connell, were correct or not, and whether Mr. O'Connell's perceptions of Judge Abel were correct or not. Really, quite frankly, I don't have a horse in this race. The state does not have a horse in this race. The state has one objective.
Unfortunately, we have a ticket.
I understand that.
So we need to know what the law ought to be and how we ought to deal with this case.
The law is that if there is an expression of bias against a party, that's the law as I understand it, then there is a problem. In this case, if one accepts the trial judge's denial of having threatened to sentence the defendant to death, then there has been no expression of bias against the party.
Well, here's the concern. Yes. I think Justice Berger articulated better than I'm about to, but in any event, bears repeating. Is there any transferred bias from counsel to the defendant, and is there any showing of bias in either the guilt phase or the penalty phase that was revealed in the restaurant conversation? Is there any evidence of bias on the part of the court that should cause concern to us during the trial or during the penalty phase?
No.
Quite apart from the fact that the outcome was determined in Washington, D.C. and not in Delaware.
Right. Yes. No. Now, I think Judge Abelman made it clear that she was disappointed primarily because that Mr. O'Connell insisted on going to trial when he did in January of 2004, rather than waiting until June of 2004 when Simmons v. Roper would be handed down, and then they would have an answer. And it's Mr. O'Connell says in his answering brief, well, that doesn't appear in the June 22nd transcript. Well, it's not in there. It's in the August 3rd transcript of the hearing with Dr. Gore, and especially on pages, at the end of that hearing is where the judge then broaches the issue of let's delay the case. If I decide, and the judge goes on saying, if I decide that the death penalty is unconstitutional, well, the state probably, nobody's really sure about this but at this point, but the state could probably appeal or take some action, and the case was going to be delayed anyhow, and why don't we just go ahead and wait until June, another 6 months, and see what Simmons v. Roper said. Then we won't have to bother picking a death-qualified jury, and the defendants are always complaining that a death-qualified jury is more guilt-prone. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but we won't have to go through that, and we'll just have a regular old first-degree murder trial, non-capital, rather than going through this. And at the end of the hearing, and the trial judge was just pushing for this. Now, I will say that at this point, this case is beginning to get moldy. It's been about, by the August 2004 hearing, the case has been around for about 3.5 years. As a matter of fact, it's been about 5 years. It's been about since the actual crime, 3.5 or so since the indictment. And the defendant had, either pro se or through counsel, previous counsel, filed speedy trial motions. Now, there's a certain amount of Penelope's tapestry, as this court has said a number of times, and that, since the defendant was also filing a lot of motions for new reappointment of counsel and other matters that required the court's attention. But But the court did suggest waiting until June. And at the end of the August 22nd hearing, Mr. O'Connell said, well, are you saying that I should, you know, contact my client and say, that's exactly what I'm saying. And then apparently that didn't happen. That it was insisted that the trial go forward as scheduled in January before Roper v. Simmons came down. And I just note that Roper v. Simmons did not come down in February, or did not come down in June, it came down in February, so at least with 2020 hindsight, it would not have been much of a wait. But there was no indication on this record, and the defendant had the opening brief to show on this record that the trial judge's decisions at trial, or at any point, really, filtered to the jury, or even showed, you know, influence the course of the trial, the decisions that the trial judge made in any way. But that's the state's position in a nutshell. Should it have happened? No. But it did. And again, the state asked the court to affirm the conviction. There are no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Whether it's accurate or not, my clock says you have 33 seconds.
How many of those 33 seconds?
Unless they were used the opposite direction.
They were used the opposite direction, I've been told. I've been having trouble with the clock today. So I'm sorry. We'll take the case under advisement.